Hi, it's Eric again. If it feels like I'm always asking you for money, it's because I'm always asking you for money. That's because producing a high-quality podcast like Making Gay History costs a lot. Between $10,000 and $20,000 for each episode, for the audio and all the extra resources and archival photos you'll find on our website. One way to help us keep bringing LGBTQ history to life through the voices of the people who lived it is to join our Patreon community, $5 a month or $60 a year. And for that, you get a front row seat to my interviews with present-day history makers, behind-the-scenes production conversations, and delicious clips from my archive that we couldn't include in regular episodes. Right now, we have 200 Patreon followers. That's just a fraction of our many thousands of listeners. Can you help us double that by the 55th anniversary of Stonewall this coming Pride Month? We can't do what we do without all our supporters. And if you aren't one already, I hope you will be soon. Or, if you are already, get one of your friends to sign up to join our Patreon community at patreon.com/makinggayhistory. That's patreon.com/makinggayhistory. Or just go to makinggayhistory.com and hit the Patreon subscription button on our homepage. Thanks so much. Now, on to the episode you've chosen to hear. I'm Eric Marcus, and this is Making Gay History. It's now been 11 weeks since my partner Barney and I began sheltering in place. And this past week, the official death toll in the United States from COVID-19 rose past 100,000. Mothers and fathers, children, grandparents, colleagues, neighbors, and friends. People. Not numbers. People. I've talked before in this series revisiting the archive about anger, how it can fuel action, how when anger is partnered with love, it can produce a kind of righteous rage that propels us. Those of us who lived through the AIDS crisis know about it. Some of us learned it from Larry Kramer, who died this week in Manhattan, where he's lived for decades. Larry was famous for being one of the first civilians to sound the alarm during that last epidemic, the one that began 40 years ago. He was on the front lines even before AIDS was called AIDS and became a global epidemic that swept away more than 30 million lives. Before AIDS, Larry was best known for his work as a screenwriter and author. But the virus that was claiming so many lives and the political indifference, political negligence that greeted it, turned Larry into a very public activist. His friends were dying, and he felt compelled to do something more than to just bury the dead and mourn their loss. In 1982, Larry co-founded the Gay Men's Health Crisis, now known as GMHC. 5 years later, he co-founded ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. ACT UP came to be known for its brilliant use of public protests to bring attention to the epidemic. By early 1989, when I first met Larry, AIDS had taken more than 60,000 lives, most of them gay men. Larry quickly earned a reputation as an uncompromising firebrand with a fierce temper. I'm not proud of it, but that kind of person generally inspires me to run in the other direction. I was more than a little anxious as I approached the door to Larry's apartment in a building that fronts Washington Square Park in New York City's Greenwich Village. As I said when this episode originally aired, I got myself worked up for nothing. I'd braced myself for a tornado and found a teddy bear. Here's the scene. Larry welcomed me into his spacious apartment and showed me into his all-white, book-lined living room, and I took a seat opposite him across a broad desk. As I set up my tape recorder and attached the mic to his shirt, we talked about how we both had wanted to find a husband early in life and settle down. And that led us back in time to Larry's memories as a confused and unhappy college student in the early 1950s. I pressed record.
Interview with Larry Kramer, Thursday, January 26th, 1989, at the home of Larry Kramer in New York City. Interviewer is Eric Marcus, tape one, side one.
When I went to Yale, I thought I was the only gay person in the world and tried to kill myself because it was so lonely.
Actually,
so,
did try to kill yourself?
Yeah.
What year
and
was
I think that was
you...
53 was the year, my freshman year at Yale. It was awful. I mean, do you want to go back that far?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm also curious because I was a college student on 76, desperately unhappy.
Where?
At Vassar College.
There were a lot of gays.
There weren't that many. People think there were a lot.
Yeah.
I always said, if there were so many gays, why was I so unhappy? But I was a miserably unhappy person, and death seemed very appealing at moments during my freshman year, when I was dating a woman and sneaking off with a man behind me. And life in 53 at Yale must have been much more difficult than 76 at Vassar.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you could even start in 53. I knew I was gay, I think, from the day I was born, and I think that there had been I now know that there were there were experiences all through before I even got to Yale, and they were all covert and guilt-inducing on everybody's part. So it seemed as if all those early years were spent trying to deny these feelings. The feelings would sort of get too strong and erupt, and I would have an experience which would always make me feel guilty in one way or another, and then you'd be calm. Vesuvius would calm down for a while.
A week or two.
And Yale was awful. There was a gay bar called Pirelli's. It was just awful the time when I finally had the courage to go there. And it was only two blocks from campus, but it was a million years away. It was very dark and gray and inside and smoky and filled with older men. I only went the once, and somebody picked me up in a car, and we drove for what seemed like hours before we found a place that was quiet to do it, and then he drove me back where you didn't say a word, all of that.
How did you try to kill yourself?
I ate 200 aspirin.
Oh my God, talk about slow and miserable death. You must have been pretty miserable to swallow 200, and you must have been even more miserable after. So you wanted out? Was that?
Who knows? It's a scene I'll never forget.
The scene of taking the pills, or the scene of waking up and finding you're still there?
I didn't wake up. I went to bed and I got scared and I called the campus police and they came and took me to the hospital and pumped my stomach. And I was in a woke. Then I fell asleep and I woke up in a room with bars, and at the Grace New Haven Hospital, and there was this very unpleasant hospital psychiatrist who said, "All right, Mr. Kramer, why did you do it?" And I said, "Go fuck yourself," or words to that. And he said, "You're not going to be let out of this hospital until you tell us why you did it." And I said, he rubbed me the wrong way, and I wouldn't have told him. Who knew why I did it anyway? So my brother, who's always sort of looked after me, came and got me out, and he was friends with the dean of freshmen. My brother had been to Yale before me, and it was, you know, ordinarily when something like that happened, you were shipped off to go join the army.
Really?
In those days, yeah. And then you can come back to Yale when you've sort of grown up. But they let me stay if I went to the university psychiatrist. His name was Dr. Fry, Clement Fry, and he was about in the 60s. He had silver hair, and he was a good-looking man. He wore his rep tie and his button-down shirt. And you just knew that he cared more about Yale than he ever did about you. And and I told him of this experience that I had had of, I had been invited to go to the room of two of my freshman year, two guys in freshman year that I had met. And they somehow mercifully had found each other, and they were living in this room, and I was invited for tea or something. And I walked into this room, and the room, you know how awful freshman year rooms are. Well, they had done their room, and it was painted all black, and there was everything had been taken out of the room except, you know, a low mattress, which was black, and there was a perfect coffee table with a rose and a vase that was spotlit in it.
Gay men are born.
And Mabel Mercer is playing on the phonograph, right? So I described this all to Dr. Fry, and Dr. Fry's reaction was, I wouldn't see those guys anymore if I were you. And that's what Yale was like, and that's what going to a psychiatrist was like. So,
and there wasn't a local gay student group for you to call.
There was. I mean, I love going back to Yale now, and this is my real yardstick of how far we've come. Even though I'm always yelling about how we've not come far enough, I go back to Yale, and Yale is like the gay college now, and there's a dance every year for well over 1,000 gay men and women in across the campus from where I tried to kill myself because I thought I was the only one.
So that is your yardstick for change.
It certainly is, yeah.
That in 30 years' time, you were completely alone.
30 years it is. Yeah, God, it's a long time. So where does that leave us? A lot of change and no change.
Well, yeah.
Well, I guess it's in my nature to be impatient. And I only got politically involved because of AIDS. And there is no question that we have lost the war to AIDS and that we've lost and will continue to lose a great many people whom we did not have to lose. And that the speed of research, treatment, education, you name it, has been tragically and inhumanely slow. It's an epidemic that need not have happened, and that we should have listened. There's no question that enough people knew what was happening.
Who should have listened? Or, the people specifically who should have listened?
Well, the community. I mean, the gay press, the gay leaders.
You were there before it was an epidemic, or just as it was becoming?
Well, I think now we know that even when we found out in 81, it was much bigger than we thought, but we thought it was just beginning, right? 81, in this very room, in August 81, 80 men sat with Dr. Freedman Keene from NYU, who told us in no uncertain terms exactly what was happening. And he was right.
In 81?
In August of 81. The New York Times article that alerted everybody really was July 3rd, 81. The New York Times headline was something like rare cancer seen in 41 homosexuals, and it said that all the guys had the same history, which was a history of having had all of these sexual diseases, amoebas, hepatitis A and B, and mononucleosis, and syphilis, and gonorrhea, and you name it. When I saw that in the New York Times, I was scared because I'd had all of that. And I guess a penny dropped, as the English say, or the bell rang or something. And I called Larry Mass, who was and is my friend, who is a doctor and who had written some articles. He wrote a health column for The Native and had written about it before the Times had. And I guess I had spoken to him peripherally about it, but not. It had the bell hadn't rung, I guess, until the time. I mean, the Times has a way of making you really sit up and say, "Wow."
Well, if the Times covers it, it has to be real.
So he said, "Go talk to Alvin, to Dr. Freedman Keene," which I did. And Alvin, who turned out to be gay, and we turned out to have mutual friends. said, this is what's happening. You got to stop fucking. You're someone well-known in the gay community. You have to do something about it. Somebody's got to go out there and tell them. And it was because of that that I invited Larry Mass and I and two other guys now dead, Donald Crinsman and Paul Rappaport, invited everyone we knew to come to this first meeting in August.
That include people from political groups, gay political groups?
We got
groups
on the phone and we called everybody. We called anyone we could think of. Political people, rich people, media people, doctors, none of whom showed up. And it was a good cross section, and it was, you know, a lot of people didn't believe him.
Did you know this was a hot political football when you picked it up? Or did you expect people would respond to you or to what you had to say?
You know, that very meeting that night with Al, it was in the early evening with Alvin, so that, I mean, there are a lot of very nasty questions put to him. There are a lot of people saying, you know, you're a born again. How can you make all of these assumptions on the basis of so few cases? And how can you expect the whole community to stop fucking? And, you know, there was no virus then. I mean, people say there's no virus now, but there certainly wasn't a virus then. And that didn't come for another couple of years. And people could say you have no evidence to base this on. And
but didn't anyone say, even if there's the slightest possibility?
Well, I mean, that's what he was saying, and that's what I was saying. It wasn't so much the people that Paul Popham and Nathan Fain, who came to be my big adversaries in Gay Men's Health Crisis, it wasn't so much that they didn't believe or not believe what was happening. Paul had, of course, lost a couple of friends by then and a lover. It was that he didn't think it was GMHC's or anybody's position to tell anybody else how to live their lives, and that people had to make up their own minds. So a lot of valuable time was lost not being the conduit. I thought I was setting up or fighting to help set up with others an organization that was going to do one thing, and that organization became and still is another.
What was it?
It was set up to spread information and to fight. To fight to make the system accountable and to spread the word of what was happening, and that, you know, we got to cool it. It was not that at all. It became very quickly. It was taken over by the social workers, and it is now what it is then. It's a social service and a very good social service organization. But it, again, that's our tragedy. It's an organization that helps people to die. It is not an organization that helps the living go on living. And we still don't have an organization to do that, you know, except maybe ACT UP, which came along much too late. Better late than never, but much too late. I blame myself. I am very cognizant of a great failing on my part, that I did not have the ability to be a leader, that I did not have the ability to deal with my adversaries and still be friends. God didn't, if there is a God, did not give the gay community a leader when the gay community needed a leader.
And you still failed. Hasn't. And you failed in that role.
And I failed in that role. I feel very strongly I failed in that role.
What does the future hold then?
I think AIDS is going to get much, much, much worse, and a lot more people are going to die. And I hope that one of these drugs is going to do something about it. But I never seem to hear of any let up in the number of people who seem to be getting sick, and that's very scary. And I'm HIV positive myself, which I've just discovered. And
you just were tested the first time?
For the first time, yeah. Mm-hmm. I, you know, for the first time, it's come home to me in an even more personal way, that my days may be numbered in a way that I didn't think of before. And that's made me real sad more than angry. I find myself going back to ACT UP, which I haven't done in a long time, because I got fed up with it.
Well, there must be a renewed personal, there's a greater personal interest than
it
before,
gives,
I would think.
That their fighting takes me out of my negativity, makes me, just sort of being touched by their positivism helps me.
There are a lot of things I haven't asked you. Is there anything that you would like to comment on?
I don't feel like I've been at my best today with you, and so
I'll come back.
Feel a little specious in what, not specious, feel a little buck scattered in what I've said. So I don't know if I've said what I love being gay, and if I have been and am critical, it's only because I think we are very special people and capable of so much more. And And it's taken me a long time to be able to say that, because I'm of a different generation than many, you know.
You were born what year?
35. Mm-hmm. And I'm the generation that was sent off to shrinks, because shrinks then thought they could change you, and you were expected to change. And it took a long time for me to come to terms with my homosexuality, and a lot of shrinks. Now, having come to terms with it and liking it, and then having to face AIDS is almost like a bum rap. Nevertheless, it's, you know, I think we are very lucky. I think being a gay man, even today, with AIDS is a wonderful thing. I love being gay.
After I turned off my tape recorder, we talked about Larry's health. Besides being HIV positive, two-thirds of his liver had been destroyed by the hepatitis B virus. His doctor had told him that he had maybe 3 years to live. So legacy was very much on Larry's mind. He told me that he saw his work as his legacy. But at the risk of disagreeing with Larry, not that he's here to argue with me, I think his biggest legacy was saving lives through the activism he inspired and his warnings about AIDS, which were heard by more than a few of us, including me. A lot of us owe our lives to Larry Kramer. Larry outlived his doctor's prognosis by several decades. Experimental drugs and a liver transplant in 2001 saved his life. Larry also got his wish to find a husband, settling down with David Webster in 1991. They married on July 24th, 2013. Larry Kramer died this past Wednesday, May 27th, 2020. He was 84. Actually, there's another memory of Larry I'd like to share before I go. I visited with Larry one more time after that 1989 interview. It was at lunch the following summer with my mother in the Hamptons on Eastern Long Island, where Larry was renting a house. They were both in their 50s, younger than I am now. I have no memory of how that lunch came about or how my mother came to be a part of it. I'm guessing she asked, and she was known to be insistent. But what I remember clearly is how much they enjoyed each other's company. Two Jews of a generation that spawned so many fighters for social justice, my mother included. They spoke the same language, and I had the privilege to sit back and listen. How lucky was I? I don't believe in heaven, but I like to think of the two of them meeting up for lunch again, looking down on us, wondering how we've made such a fucking mess of things, and urging us to fight for our lives and the future of our country. Many thanks to the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation for their ongoing support. If you'd like to join us in our mission to bring LGBTQ history to life and the voices of the people who lived it, please go to makinggayhistory.org/support or visit our website at makinggayhistory.com. This Revisiting the Archive episode was produced by Sarah Birmingham, Making Gay History's founding editor and producer, and Inga Dataya, Making Gay History's deputy director, who handles all the post-production work to get our episodes out to you. So long. Stay safe. Until next time.